Dr. Inahosa, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for speaking with us. And you're, of course, a professor at the University of Illinois, California, Los Angeles, in the Department of Chicano and Chicano Studies. And you're talking to us live from the country of Mexico right now. Is that correct?
Correct. I'm in the state of Tlaxcala, which is a very important rural state near Mexico City where very large migration out. We're here actually working with the government and microfinance organizations and universities on finding alternative strategies of economic development, the root causes of the migration issue, right? We forget that all the time. The U.S. policy thinks that it's an issue that they can handle within the United States or on the border, when in fact this is a long historical roots that has to be addressed, or else we're going to be having this crisis over and over again.
So tell us what you're seeing down there, Doctor.
Well, I mean, right now, actually, we're conducting a complete census of every single household in the state of Tlaxcala, and basically finding out where all of their people are in the United States. And the idea is that we're going to give everybody in the country, in this state, it's not that big, it's about 250,000 households, a few million people, everybody's going to get a mobile phone and a debit card on both sides of the border to do a new type of remittances. The important point about migration that we always forget is that while there's millions of people coming over to the U.S., they're working, creating billions of dollars of value to the U.S. economy, and they're sending millions of dollars back home, none of which is really being used for economic development purposes. So what we're, most of it is in cash. In fact, all of it is in cash. And what we're doing is we're setting up technology to convert that into savings accounts, which can then be turned into microfinance to create jobs and alternative economic options for people so that they don't have to migrate if they don't want to. The idea is to convert migration as a choice, not as a necessity.
So what can we here in the United States take from what you're learning down there?
Well, I mean, I'm doing this as a part of a broader project because we have to work on this issue of migration on both sides of the border. We need a transnational cooperation strategy. So right now I'm finishing three major studies, which are part of ongoing work that I do at UCLA, and have been working with many people throughout the United States and Mexico and Central America for many years on this. You know, we have to understand that what's about to happen right now, the president has to act because the Congress is incapable of acting. There's a political, as we know, deadlock in terms of being able to act. So the president, number one, has to act. But even if he does, and what we're going to show is that that's going to be an extremely positive economic move. It's extremely positive for the U.S. economy if Obama acts unilaterally. We're looking at various scenarios from 3 million to 8 million people being legalized. That in and of itself creates billions and billions of dollars of economic activity and taxes, and it stimulates productivity. All of this is extremely good for the United States. However, that in and of itself is not enough. All right. The second paper that we're releasing is that we want to be very careful that we don't fall into the same trap of doing immigration reform and saying, well, we have to complement immigration reform with massive spending on the border, okay, massive enforcement. And so our second study is called The Soaring Cost of Catching a Mexican. I think I told you once about this, where we are showing that, in fact, for the last 25 years, the United States has done nothing on immigration except throw billions and billions of dollars onto enforcement infrastructure, which has absolutely no effect on the amount of people crossing the border. Why? Because the entire reason people are crossing is simply having to do with the demand for labor in the United States. And as the unemployment rate falls, as it's doing right now, the most absolutely predictable result of that is that massive migration will occur. It's happened, and then when there's lots of unemployment in the United States, like there was 5 or 6 years ago, migration slows to a trickle. All right, in fact, people go back to Mexico. So it makes no sense to spend make the argument that, like the Republicans are saying, oh, we have to seal the border first. Seal the border first. I go on Fox News all the time, and I tell them, look, you want to know what president had the biggest decline in undocumented migration in the history of the United States, and that was Ronald Reagan. And he did it without building fences and spending billions of dollars on unnecessary infrastructure. By simply legalizing people, what ends up happening is that wages rise in the United States and the demand for undocumented immigration goes down, right? So after 1986, the total number of people crossing the border actually went down dramatically. It stayed down for more than 10 years. As we know, we've talked about on your show before, the reason that it recovered again was because there was no provisions in the Immigration Bill of 1986 for what we call future flows. So that's the thing that has to be resolved. Instead of building billions of dollars of fences, which are not going to stop the process, what we should do is make sure that we legalize people and then we create a legal mechanism for our labor market needs in the future to be met. And by legalizing people, that in and of itself is going to reduce the demand in the short run, but for the next 5-10 years, significantly of people needing to coming over based on the demand for labor in the United States. But that actually creates a dilemma, if you think about it for a second. If we legalize people in the United States, if we go even beyond what President Obama is talking about doing and we have full immigration reform, permanent immigration reform, because what Obama's talking about is basically he can only give temporary administrative relief from deportation 2 years at a time, right? What's called temporary protective status. If the Congress could act and they could make this permanent, that would be extremely good in terms of reducing the demand for immigration into the United States, illegal immigration, and it would raise wages in the United States of the immigrants. That's why you have a decline in demand. That is not good for Mexico, not good for Central America. You may say, well, that's great. No, because if you think about it, if you raise wages in the United States and the demand for Mexican immigration goes down, that means less people are going to come over, and that continues to build more pressure in Mexico and Central America, and then that could create even greater political crisis, and in the long run, people are going to just want and need to try to find some way to get over illegally, so it doesn't solve the problem in the long run. What we need to do, and that's the third report that we're doing, and that's why I'm here in Mexico, is, okay, how do we create to complement immigration reform in the U.S., either temporary or permanent, which we hope it will be permanent, how do we complement changes in the U.S. immigration policy with long-lasting strategies for economic development in all of these communities that we are now very interdependent with in the U.S. economy? So I'm in these rural areas right here. Half the villagers have already gone. They're in the United States. They're washing your dishes today and certain parking cars and cleaning babies. The question is, how can we create, from these billions of dollars of remittances that go back to Mexico, a mechanism of saving and investment that will create alternative economic opportunities for people. The unbelievable reality of it is that over the last 25 years, just from Mexico, probably more than $500 billion has gone to Mexico in remittances, but virtually none of it through bank accounts, so that it has not created a banking system that is responsive to the vast majority of the population. The money has all gone in the form of cash, and usually for short-term consumption with very little savings. And that has actually, ironically, undermined economic security in Mexico and made people a lot more vulnerable and a lot more dependent on creating opportunities for themselves by migrating. So what we're doing here, we're building strategies with microfinance organizations, again, to use cell phones, all right? This thing I'm talking to you on my iPhone right here is an unbelievable economic development tool. We're converting the cell phone into basically a bank account on both sides of the border so that people can then send a remittance from the U.S. to Mexico and tell your phone app to put 20% of it, 10% of it into a savings account, of which you will get interest rates, an interest payment, and it will accumulate capital. That's one benefit right there. Second, the money that's going into savings accounts goes into these microfinance banks, and we can leverage that two or three times to create investment opportunities, huge billions and billions of dollars of microfinance. The reality of it is today, 85% of the people in Mexico don't have bank accounts, and they can't get loans to create small businesses, even though virtually everybody is an informal business person, one way or the other. We're measuring that you could convert the remittances that go into a state like Tlaxcala, and you would have way more than enough in terms of savings and investments to create more than necessary jobs, both here, and we're also doing the same thing in Central America. So we're going to be in the White House on Friday with the Central American presidents who are coming up to meet with President Obama, and we're going to be basically working for the next month and a half with the White House as they're announcing their administrative action, to also say that we should be very careful not to fall into the temptation of spending billions of dollars more on infrastructure, even though that's what the Republicans are going to ask for, billions of dollars more on detention centers and border guards. That's completely unnecessary, and that we have to complement that with these new types of technology for a permanent long-term solution to the problem.
Let me just remind our listeners, we're speaking to Dr. Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, speaking to us from the state of Tlaxcala, Mexico. And he's down there right now working on long-term economic growth and sustainability in Mexico to help address the immigration problem at its root, working on leveraging the huge amount of remittances coming from the United States to Mexico into savings and also credit. Professor, let me ask you, you did just allude that the White House might announce some type of administrative action. Do you think it's going to be announced? And what do you think about the fact that Obama can really only promise what's going to happen for 2 years, and there's all this uncertainty with maybe a Republican coming in office? Could he repeal that, or what do you see?
Well, I mean, I actually do believe that the president is going to act, in part because he really has no choice at this point, but he has said it, and I think he's committed to it, that by the end of the year, he said five times this week, that he is going to act, and we're running a variety of different scenarios on how big that impact is and it could be, economically speaking. I think what's going to happen politically is really interesting, because basically, the Republicans are going to have two choices. One, they're either going to say, okay, fine, we will pass our own immigration reform bill and then have what the Constitution says should happen is a discussion between the president and the Congress, and that they figure something in long term and they can sign a permanent bill.
I actually think that what's going to happen is that the Republicans are not capable of coming together and passing a bill because they are deeply divided, with one group of the Republican Party being extremely against foreigners and immigrants in general, and anti-Latino in general, and they're going to oppose any form of immigration reform. They've already said that, all right? And then I think what could happen is that that group will not only block immigration reform, they will try to impeach Obama. They will basically say, oh, the president violated all types of rules by acting unilaterally, and try to impeach him. Now, the reality of it is that's completely not correct. The president is completely acting within his legal constitutional rights. In fact, every president in the last 60 years has used this congressional authority to actually help immigrants of various types. I mean, George Bush did it with the Haitians, with Central Americans. Ronald Reagan did it with the Nicaraguenses. I mean, you know, every president has used this type of authority. But you're right. This is not a permanent solution. So the Republicans have to be very careful because, I mean, if they basically, default to their current position, which is basically complete inaction and hostility towards anything Obama, and they actually go ahead and try to block immigration reform or even try to impeach Obama for doing what's constitutionally legitimate for him to do, this, I think, creates a massive backlash against the Republicans. And they've overreached before. We've seen this before. This is what happened with Newt Gingrich. And they tried to overreach and did a number of things, including impeaching the president, which became extremely unpopular. And then they lost the election. The other thing that could very easily happen is that, I mean, this sets up a 2016 race where the Democratic candidate, probably Hillary Clinton, will absolutely say she's going to continue these policies and renew them until the Congress finally acts. And I think that would be an extremely positive, a popular position of clearly mobilizing Latinos, especially that Republicans will probably end up electing somebody through their very, you know, conservative right-wing primary process, who will be saying, no, I'm not going to renew these policies. In fact, I'm going to abolish administrative action, and I'm going to deport all these people. Well, if that's going to be the debate in the 2016 election, I think the Republicans will lose, and lose real bad. It reminds me of California, where I live now. And when I first got there 20 years ago, it was a very similar setup where the Republican Party tried to run on an anti-immigrant ballot, but that ended up happening was creating a massive voter turnout among Latinos, registration and turnout, and then essentially turning California from a red state, which it was 20 years ago, to a solid blue state. And Republicans have basically never won statewide offices except for Arnold Schwarzenegger, but that was a complete fluke. But everybody else, the Republicans this time around, Republicans lost every single statewide election. And I think that that's the way it is for the country in terms of presidential politics here, that this plays very strongly into the Democrats' hands politically. Now, so I think that, you know, what's happening, we're at a historic moment where the United States is finally having to deal with the fact that they have ignored this immigration issue for now 25 years and in fact for generations have really never really dealt with the fact that we need immigrant labor, and we were perfectly happy to try to believe that, we'll deal with the problem later when we've accumulated now 11, 12 million people. Nowhere in the industrialized society does any country have 10, 12 million undocumented people working.
and working very strong and hard for the economy and not giving them any basic rights, let alone political rights, basic labor rights. So this is an untenable situation, and we're finally, the United States is having to finally deal with it. The time is up. No more excuses, and I think it's what we're going to find is that it's like in the civil rights movement of the 1960s. This is the new civil rights movement, and I think progressive people all across the country are going to rally around a very energized Latino, and I think that Obama is going to end up deserving a lot of credit. I mean, assuming he does this. I mean, if for any reason that he decides to pull back and not do this, I think it would be a catastrophe politically for him, and a lot of people who are giving him one last chance will turn against him and the Democratic Party, and it would be a disaster. But I really don't think that that's where we're heading. We're heading towards a positive outcome, but one that is going to divide the country, and that progressive forces have to get ready for this and be ready to understand why this is such a great move politically, economically, and for the future of the soul of the United States.
And Professor, before I let you go, what's the latest on the unaccompanied minor situation? What are people saying?
Well, I'm hoping that through this administrative action, you will be able to actually include a number of people who are in this situation where essentially the priority on administrative action should be to keep families together, okay? And under those circumstances, if people are here in the United States and they're eligible for legal status, their kids will also be able to fall under this temporary protective status. And then that's what I'm expecting this, you know, the current situation, which is this speed up that's going on for court or review, I don't think is the solution. I think that was a politically expeditious move on the administration's part, and I think a very wrong, situation where we're right now basically ignoring the rights of these children, as well as ignoring the root causes. So I'm hoping that the move on administrative action helps repair many of the damage over the last 6 months that has been caused here.
Professor Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, thank you so much for your time. Keep up the great work down there.
Thank you very much, and all your listeners. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon. This is, of course, the Logic Consortium, and that was Professor Raul Hinojosa Ojeda talking to us from the state of Tlaxcala, Mexico. And we'll be back in a couple minutes with Mark Krikorian.
Necessary. patience curse. He sits down, mad as hell, and drives off in a hearse.
And we're back here on the Logic Consortium, 88.7 WLUW, Chicago Sound Alliance. And here we're with Mark Krikorian, the Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies out there in the Washington, D.C. area. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
And thanks for coming back. Yeah, so we just, I don't think you heard the first half of the show probably, but we talked with Raul Hinojosa Ojeda, who's actually down in Mexico right now, and he's, but we talked to him about a different issue, but he did predict this week, well, considering this week, President Obama said five times he's going to act. So he made a bold prediction. What he said was the president's going to act. It's going to polarize the country. Impeachment proceedings are going to be commenced. And what's going to happen is the 2016 election, assuming Hillary's the Democratic or whoever, is going to be a referendum on that administrative action. And the Democrats are going to sweep in 2016. What do you think of that prediction?
Well, I think until the last part of it, it's probably correct. I think the president is going to do something on his unilateral amnesty. He's promised it over and over again. He said he's going to do it by the end of the year. A lot of the more sophisticated professional Democrats who kind of know how politics works and, you know, aren't just going to be leaving here in a couple of years, they have counseled the president to postpone it. But I actually think the fact that he was so thoroughly rebuked by the voters on Tuesday actually makes him, I think, less likely to be conciliatory. I think basically at this point he's saying, look, the voters are jerks, and they can't do anything to me for the next 2 years. So, you know, I mean, to be crude about it, F you, F the voters, I'm going to amnesty these people, and Republicans can try and stop me. That is going to make the next election a referendum on Obama's power grabs, not just immigration, but all kinds of other things. I mean, Obamacare, whatever you think of whether it's a good idea or not, the president has just repeatedly broken the law. I mean, just acted illegally in a kind of authoritarian fashion that we haven't really seen on this scale since maybe Woodrow Wilson. I mean, that level of presidential authoritarianism, kind of, I mean, I don't mean to be exaggerating here, but this is a little more like Hugo Chavez than Bill Clinton. And so because of that, I think actually the Democrats, are going to be at a real disadvantage in 2016 because they're going to end up having to defend not only a whole list of administration, failures due to just regular incompetence, because this really is an amazingly inept administration, completely apart from what you think of the substance of policy. They just don't know how to run an administration at all. But on top of all of those things, there's going to be this real, discomfort with the way this president has essentially usurped the separation of powers. I mean, we don't have a government in this country. Some countries do. We don't have a government in this country where the president is elected every 4 years and then gets to basically rule by decree and do anything he wants. And then he's up for election again. That's not what we have here, and that is what the president thinks his role is. And so I think Democrats are frankly going to be in trouble in 2016.
Mark, let me ask you. I'm not a constitutional scholar, although I am an attorney. Do you think that President Obama exercising prosecutorial discretion, which seems to be an age-old common law authority of the executive, and with the Constitution saying all authority of the executive shall be invested, all enforcement shall be invested in the executive. Do you think it's a total Bolivarian usurpation of Congress's role if the president says, hey, these people, I'm going to decide not to deport?
The answer is yes. And the reason is that the president isn't deciding not to deport them. He decided that 6 years ago. That is something more like prosecutorial discretion, essentially looking the other way and using different priorities. That is within the president's scope. Now, even there, the president has gone, I think, much too sweeping. Prosecutorial discretion is supposed to be a kind of case-by-case issue. You know, an example of it is a cop stops you for speeding, finds out you're not a wanted criminal, the car isn't stolen, you're not being a jerk, and your kid in the back is crying because she needs her diaper change, and the cop says, okay, ma'am, slow down, I'm not going to give you a ticket this time, but, you know, be careful. That's prosecutorial discretion. But what the president has been doing up to now has been exempting entire categories of people from enforcement of the immigration law, essentially like that state trooper saying, all blue Toyotas are exempt from the speeding laws. That's essentially what the president has been saying. But even that is not what he's been talking about doing before the end of the year. This executive action is not delaying deportation. It is actually would be giving millions of illegal immigrants work cards, work permits, Social Security numbers, driver's licenses, eligibility for the earned income tax credit, eligibility for affirmative action benefits, the right to travel abroad and then re-enter the country lawfully. All of that's a grant of status. It's not a green card, but it's green card light is what I'm calling it.
It's temporary, though. That would be temporary. And green card is a permanent resident status. And, of course, the Constitution says not what I said. It says the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. So it seems like, according to the Constitution, he's allowed to execute and has the discretion to execute the laws or not.
But the question is, does that discretion, that real discretion, which obviously exists, because you can't enforce every law all the time everywhere, I mean, especially now with our ridiculous plethora of laws, any executive, whether it's a governor or a mayor or a president, has to make decisions, choices, priorities. What the president really is doing, though, is, first of all, simply choosing not to enforce whole swaths of section of Title VIII of the U.S. Code. And that, first of all, goes beyond what Congress sees as president's legitimate function as in executing the laws. But like I said, this is a matter not of deciding, of looking the other way and saying, okay, you know, you're a mom, you're not a drug dealer, and you've been here for 10 years, we're just going to not pay attention to you if you're an illegal alien. This is saying, come on here, here's a work visa, here's a Social Security number, here's a driver's license, have a nice day. That's a proactive grant of status. Now, you said that it's temporary. It is indeed. It has to be renewed every 2 years.
And who knows if it could be renewed? Who, somebody else in office might take that away?
Sure, but it's never going to happen. I mean, literally, it cannot happen, and don't take my word for it. Because we have statuses like this that are legal. Congress established them, and the president has used those tools. It's called temporary protected status,
yeah.
TPS. It's basically the same thing as what the president has given those dreamers a couple years ago and is talking about doing.
The Haitian, a new one came after the huge Haiti earthquake in 2012. Exactly.
And the thing is that no one, not a single person who ever received temporary protected status was made to leave because it expired. Never. It has never happened. In fact, the first group of illegal immigrants who got this in 1991 were a bunch of Liberians who were here illegally, and the Civil War broke out there. So we said, okay, well, we're not going to deport you during the Civil War, so here's a work visa. That was 1991. They're still here. They've all been, it gets renewed every 18 months. You know, their kids are out of college. They've retired, probably some of them at this point. There is nothing as permanent as a temporary amnesty.
Mark, one thing I do want to mention, it might seem like a small minutia point, but according to many of the, like, for example, one of the biggest laws in Section 8 of the U.S. Code is classes of deportable aliens. So it says the following classes of people are deportable. It doesn't mandate the president to deport them. It just says they are deportable. So it seems like he has a ton of discretion in that area. It doesn't say, President, you must deport the following class of aliens. It says you can deport the following class of aliens.
That's true. He always has a lot of discretion. In, frankly, the president has to have a lot of discretion in a lot of areas. But what the president is doing is saying, is not saying, I'm going to exercise my discretion. And in this case of this deportable alien, there are particular reasons I'm going to let him stay. What the president is saying, he is essentially delineating entire classes of people who are exempt from the law. Entire classes of people he is not going to act against. And, like I said, and the point here is he's done that for 6 years. What he's saying here is sort of a step even beyond that, where he is defining, or will be, I mean, we haven't seen it yet, but we know it's going to happen, defining a class or classes of people, and then setting up a fee schedule for documents, and saying, not only will you people not be deported, but you're getting work visas, and wink, wink, we all understand that you're going to be able to stay permanently. That is what we're talking about here. And, you know, will Congress be able to file suit in court to stop it? I don't know. Probably not. I don't think they'd get standing. I mean, this lawsuit they threatened against the president's Obamacare usurpations, which are, I mean, there's simply no question that they're illegal. They've never filed this lawsuit, and I don't think judges would even entertain it based on standing. So ultimately, this is a political issue. The president is pushing back against the separation of powers in one of the most dramatic moves. Probably this is the most dramatic power grab in peacetime any president has ever made.
What one thing? So reviewing one of the big controversial ones that happened, obviously, over 2 years ago now, which is this deferred action for childhood arrivals, which created this, you know, ability to get a work authorization and a promise not to be deported, etc. But it's not like he just said everybody can get that. It seemed pretty rigorous. I mean, you have to have gone to school, been here from 07 to 12, cannot have a significant misdemeanor, all DUIs are knocked out, and so it wasn't, oh, and have come here when you were under 16, obviously. So it wasn't like, oh, we're opening up the floodgates. He said, listen, these young kids, I want to exercise the discretion in this case. What was wrong with that, for example?
Because Congress specifically rejected the legislation they used to base that on twice. Twice Congress voted down the DREAM Act. Now, I actually think there's a germ of an idea there in the DREAM Act. I think it's much too expansive. But for kids who came here illegally, their parents brought them when they were infants or toddlers. They've spent their whole childhoods here. There's a case to make for amnestying those kids, at least a bill that includes an amnesty for them along with other things. But Congress, the actual bill that was faced by Congress, the DREAM Act, was defeated twice. And what the president did was take this bill, which Congress explicitly rejected twice, and said, I'm going to implement this anyway. I'm sorry, but that is not what the founders of the framers of the Constitution had in mind when they're talking about a separation of powers between Congress and the executive. Ultimately, this is a political question. This isn't going to be resolved, I don't think, in the courts. The president, although he's clearly, at this point, has earned impeachment, given his, even apart from immigration, his whole slew of lawless actions, it's not going to happen. Just numerically, mathematically, it's not going to happen because you need two-thirds of the Senate to convict. And it doesn't matter. We're not going to impeach the first black president, no matter how bad he is. But That's why 2016 matters. Essentially, there's now, if the Republicans have any abilities, political abilities, and I still wouldn't credit that, it's a two-year campaign to make the case that the executive needs to be reined in, needs to be limited, because the President Obama has shown an example of what a president who really basically has no regard for legal limits is able to get away with.
When they rejected Congress, the DREAM Act, is that the 2010? Didn't the House pass it, and then Congress couldn't get the 60?
The House passed it.
The House,
the Senate.
That's what I'm saying. I'm sorry. The House passed it, and the Senate
this
couldn't get the 60 votes.
Yeah, exactly, because there were not enough Democrats voting for it.
So it passed by majority in the
This is not a plebiscitary. This is not, again, this is the sort of Chavez thinking. We have rules.
But hold on. When were those 60 cloture rules initiated and followed to a T? Haven't those gone back and forth, the terms of the Congress and Senate bylaws?
I'm sure they have. Yeah, of course they
have. So it's not like a Bolivarian thing to say, oh, this is against our principles of a country.
The rules are what they are now. Now, maybe they'll change in the future, and maybe some of these rules should be changed in the future. They're not changed now. You don't get to say, well, you know, the rules weren't like this all the time, and even though this is now our procedures, it may change in the future, so let's just disregard the results of the actual legislative process until the rules are more to my liking. Sorry, that's not rule of law. I mean, it just isn't. We're entering a really dangerous period, I think, here. Put us immigration aside, a very dangerous period for our constitutional order. There really is increasing indifference toward the meaning of actual rules and the applicability of those rules. I mean, a few years down the line, it wouldn't surprise me at all if the Supreme Court says, well, you know, the requirement in the Constitution that the president be born a U.S. citizen, that doesn't really mean what it says, and we're going to overturn it. And people will kind of shrug, and some people will complain. And, you know, we're going to get to a point where words literally no longer have any meaning beyond what the political, beyond what the political pressures ascribe to them at any given moment.
Well, we, of course, know the law is what the Supreme Court says the law is.
Well, I mean, there is a lot of that. Yeah, exactly. But even there, they try, they don't try all that hard for, to come up with some plausible pretext. But essentially, this is now what the president's doing. It's the same kind of fake emanations of penumbras and all that kind of nonsense, where the Supreme Court simply makes up law. The president is just making stuff up. And if he gets away with it, the next... tell me, what is to prevent, say, another Republican president who wants to reduce, say, the death tax, the inheritance tax, and Congress refuses to do it. It passes one house, it fails in the other. And he says, we can't wait for this to happen. Every day, people are dying and their estates are being taxed at this unjust rate. So I'm instructing the IRS to simply disregard the statute and collect only the amount of tax that I made up off the top of my head.
I don't think that's a perfect analogy, because that would be action where Congress has spoken against as opposed to inaction where Congress has not spoken.
Like giving work visas to...
Employment authorization.
Yeah,
it's a different story.
It's not work visas in the sense that you're a foreigner. It's an employment authorization document. It's a photo ID that says you have the right to work and this is who you are. You get a Social Security number with it. My only point here is that's a proactive step. That's not a passive step. That's a proactive step. And it is very much like essentially picking a new tax rate and enforcing it.
I do want to kind of step back a little bit and talk. I love the debate with Reason, with Naraste, and Brian Kaplan.
Right, yeah.
And I kind of want to address a main, back and forth in that debate, which is this...
Was this the one from a few months back?
Yeah, the one in May.
Right, yeah, okay, good.
Yeah, I thought it was very, you know, stimulating and intriguing. Seems like they did a great job there. So it's this idea that Kaplan brought up at the beginning, which is that we shouldn't be looking at the negative effects maybe to one or many Americans from immigration. What we should be looking at, and he likened it to, oh, of course, if we have driverless cars, the truck drivers would become upset. And just like I remember, you know, people were saying, oh, we shouldn't have tractors, or the manual farmers would be out of business and things like that. Sure. So he's saying, hey, you know, we've got to be looking at production and production. More stuff produced means more stuff consumed. We need more workers. Every worker in this country adds value. Production is good for people. And he gives this whole thing. So, I mean, I guess you, where do you differ? Because he basically says, and I've heard Naraste say this before, I say, what are the people don't understand who you argue with? He says, they don't understand that the pie is not a fixed size. The pie gets bigger. It's this, you know, libertarian notion that...
Sure, sure, I understand.
Yeah.
I don't even disagree with that. But there's a number of points to make. The first point is, a country is not an economy only. A country has an economy. It's not that it is an economy, number one. Number two... the arrival of more people will, in fact, make our economy bigger. There's just no question about that. If everybody from Bangladesh moved to the United States, we would have a much larger overall economy. But each one of us, on average, would be worse off because the overall GDP and the per capita GDP are different concepts. Number three, we're talking about the arrival. Brian Kaplan, the one you're referring to, he's a professor, an economics professor at George Mason University, basically says anybody who wants to move here should be able to, period. Just like there's no controls between states, within the United States there should be no controls between countries. If any regular guy in a bar thinks about that for a second, imagine how many people in Congo would move here, or Bangladesh would move here.
But you, Mark, real quick, I'm sorry, you even conceded there that he didn't say that necessarily. He thought that there should be reasonable checks on background, criminal history backgrounds, terrorism things, etc.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it depends on which day he's talking. He often says there should be no controls. He says there's no controls between states.
But I think you conceded that, and then you said, let me give my arguments against open borders light, which gives some reasonable background checks.
Yeah, because I was actually thinking that's what he was going to say, and it turned out that, because I spoke before him, he's actually much more radical than Naraste is. Alex Naraste, this is a writer at the Cato Institute, he's more along what you're describing, where anybody... who wants to get a job here, anybody wants to move here for any reason should, but they should be checked for, you know, terrorism and crime and communicable disease. That's at least a kind of...
But I want you to argue against Narastes then, basically saying, hey, workers are good for this country. It's, you know, also it's against our morals as a society to say, hey, a worker should not be able to work for a willing employer, a willing worker, and somebody should not be able to rent from a willing landlord.
The basic point here is that what that argument puts forth is that anyone who wants to move into the United States should be able to do so. Again, just let's just concede not any peaceable person who wants to move here should be able to do so. The problem is that is several fold. The one that immediately pops out at you is that we in a modern society have a very highly developed government sector, including welfare state, so that when allowing people to settle here who will make extensive use of government services, as any low-skilled person will, not because of a moral fault, but because in a modern post-industrial economy, if you have a fourth-grade education from Honduras or Congo or Bangladesh, you are going to qualify for a whole raft of welfare programs. And the libertarian response to that is, okay, let's just, you know, get rid of the welfare state.
Or what if you get rid of it to newly arrived immigrants? Let me give that argument. Put that caveat in there. What's your argument against basically open borders light when you say, hey, these people won't necessarily get welfare, but they're allowed to come, live, and work here?
My first objection is that it's a fake scenario, is that there is no such thing.
Can you indulge me?
Okay, I will in a second, but I only want to, after we discuss that, I want to discuss how I can run faster when we have less gravity here on Earth, because that is as unreal and as impossible a situation as keeping poor people from abroad off our welfare systems once we let them in. But, okay, let's say we let them in, and we manage somehow magically Willy Wonka style to keep them off the welfare system. What we end up with is something more, an economy and therefore a society, more like the Persian Gulf sheikdoms, where Americans essentially do less and less work because more and more jobs are taken over by desperate, hungry foreigners willing to work, not even cheap necessarily, but potentially even just for room and board if they can get into the United States somehow. So it has a moral and social consequence of creating a kind of master class and servant class. And the New Republic actually published an article recently along the very lines you're talking about, saying the United States should adjust its immigration policy, open its immigration policy, so that we can have a country more like Qatar in the Persian Gulf, where a handful of citizens are serviced by a large, overwhelming majority of foreign workers who have no rights. I don't want to live in that kind of country. We tried it back in the South before the Civil War, and it didn't work out very well. And forget about the slavery argument. Even if it's all voluntary, the social consequences, the kind of society, a master-servant society that you create through that, is not worth any economic benefit that might come from it.
Mark, I'd have to say that given our protections that we have in this country of indentured servitude, 13th Amendment, this type of thing.
Well, you're the one saying that we can somehow keep them off of welfare. You're talking hypothetical. I'm talking hypothetical.
Right, but I'm saying just because you keep them off of welfare doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be, you know, treated as terribly as these workers are treated in Qatar.
Well, my point isn't, though, that the workers themselves will be treated terribly. I mean, that's a secondary concern for me. They're not Americans. They're not my fellow countrymen. I'm talking about the corrosive, subversive effect it will have on American society, and you're already seeing it with the dramatic decline in work among young people. The more immigrants there are in a metro area or a state, the less and less likely it is that American teenagers and young people work. They essentially, the idea, the sense kind of is, this is, you know, mowing lawns and what have you is work that little brown people are supposed to do and not us. And that's kind of the leading wedge of the kind of master-servant divided society that you end up with in the Persian Gulf, or even a little island of ours that we own in the Northern Marianas, they're called, north of Guam, ran its own immigration policy. They imported huge numbers of Chinese and Filipinos and Bangladeshis to do all the work. And at one point, the governor actually had to prohibit welfare recipients from importing foreign workers because Bangladeshi servants were willing to work so cheap that even people on welfare could hire servants. That basically is the kind of dystopian society that open immigration inevitably would lead to.
Inevitably?
Yeah, inevitably. I don't think there's any way to avoid that. And I don't want to experiment anyway. It's not worth the risk.
Mark Krikorian, thank you so much for coming back on the program. We hope to speak to you again in the future.
Thank you.
Have a great night.
Bye.